April 18th, 2020. The residents of the small town of Portapique, Nova Scotia, went to sleep that night not knowing they would wake up to mayhem. In the middle of the night, many were woken up to gunshots and flames billowing in the night sky. An anonymous alert by the RCMP left many not knowing what was going on. By 11:26 a.m. on April 19th, 2020, 23 people were dead, 3 people were injured, and the man responsible for it all, dead. Questions remain. How did the shooter get away with this? Why didn't the RCMP warn residents sooner? How could a civilian be dressed as an RCMP officer and drive a replica car and leave so much carnage behind? An inquiry into the actions that took place have found that the RCMP failed in its role to protect the people of Portapique and the surrounding area that day, leaving a number of neighboring communities destroyed forever.
I can say it no better than Officer Campbell on the stand when he apologized for failing and saying he would do better.
I apologize for failing.
He, in a very heartfelt way, said to the world that we failed you and we'll do better. And he's a high-ranking RCMP member.
Today on Context, Canada's deadliest mass shooting. 23 dead, 3 injured, and communities torn apart. Where was God? Welcome to Context. I'm Maggie John. We are on Portapique Beach Road in Nova Scotia, the site of Canada's deadliest mass shooting. We're standing right in front of the property of Gabriel Wortman, where his house used to stand before he torched it and took a rampage throughout this area, killing 23 people and injuring 3, leaving this community shattered forever. Dan Ahlstrand is the news director at City News 95.7 in Halifax and covered this story extensively.
So Dan, take me back to April 18th, 19th. When did you start getting information about what was happening in Portapique?
Well, the event itself began on the 18th, but we really didn't know anything about that until the morning of the 19th. The RCMP had put out a tweet at like 11:30 at night, saying that there was an incident underway, but they didn't really describe sort of what was going on. They were telling people that was a weapons call, to lock their doors and not to go to the area, which, to be quite honest, is not out of the ordinary. Whenever there's some kind of weapons call, it could be a stabbing, it could be a firearm, it could be a search warrant. We get those quite often. So it was 11:30 at night, I think. Really didn't think much of it. In fact, I was already in bed. I got up Sunday morning, and I looked at my Twitter account when I got up. It was just after 8 o'clock in the morning, and the RCMP had put out an active shooter situation tweet, which was the first tweet I think that they had released to the public in about 8 hours. That was out of the ordinary. So I immediately called the newsroom. We had a weekend anchor on at the time, and I said, "Did you see this?" He said, "Yeah, I just saw it now." And I said, "Well, I think this is going to be something." So I decided that, you know, it's time to give up my Sunday and jumped in my vehicle and started heading here. On my way here, I was thinking, well, this looks like it's happening somewhere in the DeBert area, up by the Masstown Market, which is a pretty famous place where everybody kind of knows. And I thought, well, am I going to do a better job to our listeners to either come to the radio station or to drive up to the Masstown Market? Normally, in these situations, I would have just grabbed my recording gear and headed up to the scene to try and get some, you know, pictures and audio and those kind of things. But for whatever reason was, I didn't, and I came to the radio station. It turns out that was probably a smart thing to do, as the thing was still unfolding.
And as you started to hear it unfold and realize this is a mass shooting situation, how are you comprehending this as you're also translating this information to your listeners?
Really didn't, to be quite honest, didn't know. We knew that it was a big event. I think the police had told us there were multiple victims, but at that point never put a number on anything. So we just went to the air and relayed the information that we were getting from the RCMP, to be quite honest, which was quite limited at the time.
Yeah.
It became more of a focus on the the chase for Gabriel Wortmann at the time, right? It wasn't anything, we didn't have any real information. We knew that was significant, but we didn't have any real numbers or anything along those lines. So we focused on the news that was unfolding at the time, and that was the chase to try and catch this guy. And it was almost like a play-by-play, to be quite honest. We were getting information from the RCMP. At that point, they started to tweet a lot more, so we were relaying that to our listeners that you know, there was sightings of this car. And then later on, it wasn't at the beginning, it wasn't until later on that they told us that it was a replica RCMP cruiser that he was driving. And then there were sightings in Wentworth, and there were sightings on Highway 102, and there were sightings all over the place. And then the eventuality when he made his way to Enfield and to where the chase ended.
Yeah. When did you hear about what had happened at the fire brigade in
Onslow?
Oh,
that wasn't until much later.
Really?
There was obviously anecdotal information that had gotten out, but we hadn't heard anything really concrete on it until much later after this was over. Wow. that those fellows were shot at by the police. It wasn't until, my memory, probably 2 days later, maybe, something like that.
So when did you get the numbers? 22?
Well, we never got 22 at the beginning. Right? At the beginning, the RCMP held a news conference the evening of the 19th. That was, I think it was Superintendent Chris Leather was the speaker at the news conference. And he told the media that there were 10 and maybe more. And that was contrary to all the information that we'd been hearing. At first, the number we were hearing from social media was 13. But he said 10 or more. And then it was the commissioner of the RCMP, Brenda Lucky, who said that there was 17. So it was conflicting information right from the start. We didn't have any emergency alerts or anything to work off of like that. It was all Twitter, and Twitter, for its good and its bad, is sometimes less than accurate. But it was the first news conference after things had wrapped up on the 19th. I think the Wortmann chase ended at about 11:30 in the morning. We got a news conference that evening. I don't remember the time, but it was around supper time. And they were telling us there was at least 10, but they might find more as there was burning buildings and they were still kind of working their way through. But it turns out, as part of the Mass Casualty Commission, that they knew there was at least 17 at the point when they were telling us it was 10. So there was a lot of information that the RCMP were holding back on for whatever reason, which made our jobs more difficult, obviously, getting the truth out.
There were failures in communications with the public during and in the aftermath of the mass casualty. These must be addressed.
Joy McCabe lives next door to the fire station. On the morning of April 19th, 2020, the RCMP was canvassing this area. They knew that the shooter was driving in a replica RCMP vehicle and dressed just like them. That morning, they stopped here and started shooting at who they thought was the shooter in the driveway of the fire station. Joy saw everything unfold from her kitchen window.
We were up till about 20 after 1, and so it'd be early Sunday morning. And as I'm going to bed, I always just check some of my messages. Okay. Well, it said a shooter or gunfire down in Portapique. Well, they have parties down there quite often on a Friday or Saturday night, so we didn't think anything of it.
And Portapique is how far from?
It's about a half hour.
Okay.
Yes, on the old highway.
And we're in Lower Onslow right now.
Yes, in Lower Onslow.
About half an hour from Lower Onslow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, I didn't think anything of it, went to sleep, and still didn't think anything of it in the morning. So I'm out here, like I said, cooking the breakfast, and my phone kind of dinged, and I thought, okay, I'll just check and see who it is. And somebody way across town, the other side towards New Glasgow, was messaging me, telling me that the shooter was in our area. But I thought, okay, I still have time. I'm safe in my house. Yeah. I have time to finish cooking breakfast. And when Pat and I sit down, I'll talk about it. Yeah. I hear a bang over at the fire hall, but I don't see anything. And then I just kind of looked again, and a Navy car pulled up out in the middle of the road, and two men got out.
Yeah.
And they just kind of slid, like in a movie, across the front of the car and started shooting.
Towards
our house, towards the fire hall.
Wow.
So anyway, I just yelled to my husband, they're shooting. But I was brave enough to go back and stand by the window and look down, because I thought, if whoever they're shooting at is right here in front of our house, and there was a guy crouched down. So just between our truck and the car.
Wow.
And so I thought, maybe that's the shooter.
Mm.
And so I just kind of ran, tried to find a place to hide, told Pat to get up, and I said, come see. He didn't know anything about what was going on, and I only knew a little bit because I had seen it on Facebook.
Right.
And so anyway, he got up, he went to the window, I jumped down those stairs with my bad knees, locked the door, came up, locked this door, went around the house looking for a place to hide, but there's no place to hide. Wow. Like, you just, like, in a house. And I mean, if he was to come in shooting, you can't go down to your basement unless there's a door to get out. And so, you know, I was just...
scared.
Scared, yeah, really scared.
This road that's in front of your home is the main road, correct?
Yes.
So would the shooter have been driving up this road?
Yes, he did go by a little bit before the shooting happened here.
Okay.
So whether they heard or thought they heard that he was somewhere in this area, we don't know.
Talk to me about the trauma of what you saw that day. How are you processing everything that you saw?
I'm doing a lot better now than I did before, but I had nightmares every night. And my husband had to go to work, so that meant that as soon as he went to work, I would go down the stairs, lock the door, hope that nobody, even when people knocked at the door, I sat in my chair. It was like I was frozen to my spot. Like I, you know, trauma was just too much. And I kept thinking of ways that if it ever happened again, that I could, you know, so they wouldn't kill us or something. Is there ways that I could talk them out of it? Is there way, like, it just all these crazy thoughts went through my head. Like, I just didn't, you know, it was really hard. Like, I said, just to watch the people. And I didn't realize that more people in our neighborhood got to see it. So when I got together with them and heard their story, then it gives you a little more confidence, or, you know, you feel a little better because you're not the only one that's feeling the way you feel.
Yeah. How does this community heal? I mean, you were just telling me you've been in this home for over 40 years.
Yes.
This is really the community that you've known for so long.
Yeah.
So how does it heal?
I don't know. My healing comes from my faith and my church and everything. You know, they keep me strong. My husband is really great for, you know, being there to support me and everything, and help me through the nightmares and stuff. But I, the last little while, I haven't had any at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but that's what keeps me going. And the people around, I'm what kind of keeps them going. They look for, you know, joy, they say.
Yeah.
You know, if we need anything or need a hug, we just call Joy.
Mm. Coming up, I talked to two pastors who have been left to care for this community. 3 years after the horrific mass shootings, what does healing look like?
In our fast-paced world, context is everything to the stories that are shaping us. We want to go beyond the headlines in our new podcast to create space for meaningful conversations, to explore where faith intersects with justice, ethics, culture, and society. We'll be joined by newsmakers, peacemakers, and culture shapers. Join us on all podcast platforms or at contextbeyondtheheadlines.com.
Trinity United Church is one of a few faith communities in the area. They lost a member of their church that fateful day. Reverend Glenn McLean is the pastor.
Your community has gone through a lot. How's it doing today, 3 years later?
Well, I think that people are, to some extent, still maybe in a state of shock, but they've rallied together very well and been very supportive of each other. And that's been a big plus, I think. And people reaching out to each other, that's been saving grace, I suppose, of the, a very tragic situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You always find in time of trial that communities rally together.
Mm-hmm.
But even more, I think, faith communities, there's a certain aspect, a special aspect to that, being able to rely on somebody bigger than yourself.
Yes.
How has faith played that role? Jesus played that role in the healing process of mm-hmm. this community.
Yeah. I think that first the challenge of these things happening in COVID times, what happens is that the normal way that you would approach it doesn't really work because you can't just go and visit people and be a friend or be a listener. Because of the restrictions at that time, we were not allowed to really go and see people at all or even have public services. So that's changed things. But I think what we see is that, as you mentioned already, the families particularly, but also whole communities, and not just in our own area here, but right across Canada and around the world, really, people wanted to try to help out. Mm. And they wanted to try to be present and do something positive. And it's difficult because so often I think what happens is we try and do something when what's maybe more important is to be able to be someone for that individual or group of people, as the case may be.
Yeah, being present for that person.
Yeah, and listener.
Yeah. Your church in particular lost a member
yes.
of your church through this horrific experience.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Lisa, who she was.
But Lisa became a part of our congregation a couple of years before this terrible day. And she and her children came and visited and worshiped with us. She was very much a bubbly presence. Mm-hmm. And a great person to have around, and they I think were welcomed by the congregation and fit right in. So it's a pretty heavy blow.
Yeah. Hmm. From what you know of that day, what happened? How did Lisa die?
Well, there's no nice way of putting it, I guess. You know, it was just. These reckless shootings by a person that was crazed at the time. And one of the things that impressed me a great deal, I think having heard the story part that we heard here, was how she made sure that her kids were kind of secreted away and before she went outside, something was going on outside, and she went out to try and see what was going on and maybe intervene. And I think it had to do with fires, like there was some fires going on in the area. And so, true to her character, I would say, she was trying to be a helpful presence and got in the way of somebody that was on the lunatic fringe at the time.
What was it like when you heard Lisa's name and heard that she was a part of the 23 people that had been killed?
Well, I think it was difficult in a variety of ways. Because I knew her as a person, that was hard. Mm. I knew her as a teacher and a grade school, elementary school teacher, where the kids would just adore her. Mm. And she was, so well thought of in that community. But then from a standpoint of trying to minister in that particular situation in COVID times made it very difficult.
When you started hearing of all the news unfolding in the early days and you heard the name of the shooter,
yes.
there was a connection. You knew the shooter.
Yes, I did. I live in the community of Dartmouth. I was a minister there for 23 years before I came here, and the shooter was my neighbor. He operated a business, a dentures business, in Dartmouth, and you know, we had a number of over-the-fence conversations and so on. He was building a garage and I was about to, and so we talked about that a little bit and things like that. So I knew the person involved, and that didn't make anything any easier.
Yeah. When you heard the details of the fact that so many of his neighbors suffered at the hands of his anger that mm-hmm. night, did it make you wonder, Glenn, what if he had lost his temper while he was living close to you? Could you have been a victim?
Well, in hindsight, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the time, I just never really thought very much about it. I don't think in the former days. He was a neighbor for probably 6 or 7 years, and we didn't have a lot to do with each other, but we certainly talked over the fence, as I say.
Yeah.
It's but it sounds like kind of a snapping, you know, and we don't know, do we? I mean, we're complex beings. Mm-hmm. So you try and figure out, it's not trying to provide any excuses for anybody, but you don't know what kind of things other people are living under or enduring.
You presided over the memorial service for Lisa.
Yes.
And you said thousands of people have watched that memorial service.
Well, that was the indication that came from the funeral director. We had the service at the funeral home with just the family present, but it was live streamed. And the funeral director indicated that there were over 10,000 views, which was just astounding. But I think it was for the whole province. Everybody was kind of keeping an eye on what's going on, you know, and had a particular interest in it.
Yeah, Glenn, what do you say at a memorial service like that, knowing how a young mom who was just full of so much life has senselessly been killed? How do you speak words of hope?
Yeah. Not very easily.
Yeah.
But I think what I tried to do in my part of the service, because I shared it with one of the Truro ministers, was that to indicate that we live in a small bubble, so to speak, in the Nova Scotia community. People are sometimes well known to each other, one community to another. I tried to make some connections with family, and that, you know, that we all have an interest in each other, and because we know each other over the years, it makes it a little more personal. And I didn't try to explain things away, or because there's no point in doing that. It's just a tragic situation, and sometimes what you try to do is to say that, you know, over the ages, over the generations, there are all kinds of unfortunate things that happen, sad things that happen, and what we do is to try to focus on the fact that the Lord's my shepherd, for instance, is very common, and I use it a lot in trying to relate to people and saying, whatever happens in our lives, the one thing we can be sure of is that God is always present with us.
Yeah.
And whether we're on a good track or a bad track, that's true. God is always with us. And people seem to get a fair bit of comfort from that.
For Scott Penner, pastor of the Truro Alliance Church and the chaplain of the Fire Brigade, he took to his computer in the early days after the shooting to share with his community ways he was processing the pain.
Just, I wrote, we couldn't meet in person. So the Sunday after, so it would have been about a week after we met after the event, then I sent out a devotional to the congregation, and I started like this. It's been quite a week. I've personally been angry. I've been weepy, agitated, pensive, distracted. I've eaten way too much. I looked on Kijiji too often. But I've also gone for a jog, sought after God earnestly, been more thankful for life, family, friends around me than I've been for a while. I've had contact with lots of people who care about me and about you, to the church family. I've dreaded having to write a devotional following the mass shootings, and I've longed to connect with all of you by sharing these devotional thoughts. I've pondered so many what ifs that I've had to tell my mind to create a different narrative. So I've been pretty mixed up. How about you? So that whole devotional, that whole thought, that day was nothing about here's what to do or anything. It was just kind of giving people permission to feel all of what they were feeling. And so that was kind of my first thought, or the first thing that I wanted to do, is just let people be okay with engaging with God. And God can handle that, like the gritty, raw, unedited version of what's going on inside of them. Let it out.
So where was God that day? Well, the answer depends on who you talk to. But for Joy, God is found in the small things, like seeing color once again.
So Joy, these are some of the paintings, your artwork, that came out of this trauma that you've been experiencing. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I just decided I would take a paintbrush, see if I could paint something, and I ended up with dark paintings, and everybody said, how come you did the black and white? And I said, because that's all I saw for a whole year. I didn't see blossoms, flowers blooming, or rhododendron plants, or apple trees, no blossoms, nothing.
I didn't see color.
I didn't see color at all.
Like you visually couldn't see color?
No, I probably could, but it's just that whatever trauma I was in, I don't remember any blossoms. I don't remember the sun shining or the beautiful sunsets we were getting, nothing. And then year or so later, I'm looking at all the beautiful sunsets on Facebook, and I said, when did these happen?
Wow.
And I said, oh, we got blossoms on the trees this year, and Pat said they were there last year too.
There's a lot to process as we've been here in the Portapique and surrounding area, a small town where people knew everyone. They knew what everyone did for a living. They knew their neighbors. They would take food and soup and care for each other. And then in one night, everything would change. A community would be destroyed. As we've sat with some members of the community and heard their pain, I think the one thing that has been left with me is that healing cannot be rushed. Healing takes time. And 3 years after a community has been destroyed by its own, that takes time as well. But something else has really stuck with me, that faith can be an essential part of that healing process. While, as Reverend McLean said, it's not the insurance policy. It doesn't fix things right away. Being able to rely on something bigger than yourself, someone bigger than yourself, brings a bit of reassurance that you can't do it alone, that you have to do it with community. It makes me think that in the years to come, Portapique, while forever will be known as the place of Canada's deadliest mass shooting, hopefully can also be known as a place of healing and hope and joy once again. Thanks for watching. Let us know what you think of today's topic. Join the conversation on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter. For all of us here, I'm Maggie John. See you next time.
Thank you for your ongoing support of Crossroads, a supporter-funded nonprofit organization and member of the Canadian Centre for Christian Charities. Thanks to faithful people like you, we are able to continue producing context. You can write to Crossroads, P.O. Box 5100, Burlington, Ontario, L7R 4M2, or visit crossroads.ca to learn more about our programs.
Context Beyond the Headlines invites you to an exciting new season. This year, we're expanding our reach with a brand new podcast that will explore the interaction between faith, justice, culture, ethics, and society. As we move forward with this brand new season and the launch of this brand new podcast, would you consider partnering with Context financially? It is because of the generosity of viewers like you that we're able to continue to tell the stories that matter.